I'm Alan Combs. This is Teal Planet. And on Heal Planet, what we do is we talk to the world's thought leaders in human consciousness and explore human consciousness from all its angles, unlike anything else you hear on talk radio or on spoken word radio. And the term Heal Planet, we hope, is an affirmation for where we'd like to take the planet, how we'd like to heal it, even if we do it just one person at a time. Diana Lang has written a book called Opening to Meditation, A Gentle Guided Approach. Dan, I'm curious to know a little bit about your background and how you came to be writing this book and your interest in meditation.
Well, I've been teaching for 35 years, and mostly in Los Angeles over these years, but I've taught internationally as well. But I'm, you know, born here in LA and teaching from this place primarily, and I call it the front line. You know, because Los Angeles can sometimes have a bad reputation of being fake, you know. And
you're keeping it real.
Yeah, and meditation's all about being real. And so, you know, I think partly being born here and growing up in this kind of a place, I don't know if that was part of what pulled me into meditation, but certainly I was looking for meaning and being a real person and being an authentic person. And I think it was my own searching, of course, that brought me to meditation, of trying to make sense out of my own life. And then through that, I had a gift for teaching others how to find that place inside themselves.
Isn't it interesting that over the last couple of years, meditation has almost become mainstream and getting all kinds of attention it previously did not get?
Yes, I mean, everybody's meditating now, and more than that, I think a lot of people were meditating before, but it was more secret or private, you know, and I think more and more people are talking about it, like on Oprah, you know, Super Soul Sunday and all those kinds of things. It's self-help has become so mainstream now, where, you know, that wasn't the case 15 years ago or even 10 years ago like it is now. And so the conversation is up on the planet. And to me, it's about, you know, healing the planet, as all of us having a kind of mass consciousness evolution revolution.
Right. That's why we call this Heal Planet. I'm fascinated to learn that you wrote this book in meditation. Could you take us through that process? How do you write a book in meditation?
Well, you know, I have a meditation practice, so I know how to meditate with my eyes closed or meditate with my eyes open, in a sense. When you have a practice built, pretty soon what happens as you, you know, keep connecting to that place over and over again, you know, day after day after day, it begins that you will begin to meditate all the time, or you can by choice, because meditation is consciousness, right? The choice to be conscious. So when you practice meditation, you're practicing staying awake inside yourself and staying conscious. And so after a while, you begin to become conscious any place you are, and including in writing or including in a conversation, including in this conversation you and I are having, you know, even though we're apart in distance, in order to do this, we have to be very present to each other, you know? So
are you meditating right now?
I am. In a sense, right? In the sense that I'm paying complete 100% attention to what I'm doing while I'm doing it. And the one other aspect I would add, because in the book I do say I wrote it in a meditation, and that was my experience, is meditation adds a lens or a filter, I should say, of purity. And so when I wrote that book, it was coming through that filter of purity. So there was nothing about what I had read before of all the studies I've done. I was trying to kind of almost channel the cleanest line that I could be true to. And that's why the book is written simply, because when something's true and pure, it is simple.
What I like about your book is not a lot of gobbledygook in it. It's really written so even I could understand it. Oh. Or somebody who might be interested in meditation or new at it and doesn't know all the jargon involved in meditation. But I want to dig a little deeper here in terms of what the process was like for you writing it. Were you in some kind of altered state when the words came to you?
I guess you could say that in a sense, but it's not in any kind of, you know, if you were sitting right next to me, you wouldn't find me acting differently. It's like I was saying about this filtering. When you meditate, you learn to line up with light. You learn to line up with universal energy, right? And so my personality, myself, kind of is in service to that. And so I don't let what my training is not to let the ego attachment or my Diana, right, that has a point of view and an opinion on things, kind of gets out of the way of this very pure stream.
So Diana, get out of the way so you could write this book.
Yes.
Why should people meditate?
That's my whole life is dedicated to that. It changes every aspect of the life, right, because it brings more consciousness. One of the, and presence, right, and authenticity into the life. One of the kind of teaching stories I tell is, or an idea I teach is, wouldn't you rather hire a lawyer that meditates, or a doctor that meditates, or have a mother that meditates, or a teacher that meditates? Because even if you don't understand what meditation is, what you will know is by the feeling that we understand about meditation is it adds a kind of depth, you know, of a real awake person on the other side. So when we are, you know, at the bank talking to the teller, they're, you know, thinking about what they're going to do tonight maybe, or something else than what they're doing, where a person that meditates has a practice in place that they are wanting to contribute to and be a part of, so that when you're talking to that very same person that meditates, that's the bank teller, they're really listening to your concern, really trying to solve that problem. They tend to have better character issues because they wouldn't steal or they wouldn't lie, you know what I mean? Because so much of that is part of a spiritual practice.
And because they're living in the present, right? They're focused on the present moment. So when you go to the dry cleaners, you say, before I give you my dirty clothes, I want to make sure you're a meditator.
No, but I am. And so what happens is, you know, when you have a meditation practice, when you bring that presence to the dry cleaner, whatever part of the dry cleaner that has any kind of consciousness and presence within themselves will co-respond to that, you know, light to light in a sense. And by being present ourselves, we sort of wake up those that are around us.
We're talking to Diana Lang, opening to meditation. Here's the big question. How do you meditate?
Well, that's mainly what the book is about, is so that a person that has never meditated before, you know, they could sit down and do a meditation. And like I said, because the book was written as a meditation, the whole thing is a meditation, but it actually talks about like what to do and how to meditate. And then inside the book, there are links to guided meditations so that you could sit down right then and there and meditate with me kind of leading you through the meditation.
Right. I know that was a big question that requires, it's such a broad question, but could you give us a thumbnail in terms of what would be an example of how one could go about doing this?
To start a meditation practice?
Sure.
Right. Well, the first thing and the main thing is to sit quietly, right? To just become still within yourself. And usually in a meditation practice, we would sit. But I always tell people you're probably meditating and don't know it. Like when you, for people that are musicians, you know, when they get into that certain kind of place where they're following the music, you know, or an artist or a runner for that matter, when they get into that zone, those are little kind of mini meditations. But if you want to build a conscious meditation, then there is a sitting that is required where you would sit for a few minutes at least and become still within yourself so that you start to learn how to tame, in a sense, the ego mind that's running all the time, chasing every thought, like, and they call it, you know, the 100 monkeys in your brain, you know, that monkey mind that we're chasing after thought, and we don't know how to become still. Even the most practiced meditator is dealing with that condition because the mind thinks, and so you can't, you know, fight City Hall. You know, the ego and the mind is a thinking apparatus. But what you're looking for are those spaces that are in between the thoughts.
So there are times when I will meditate and I'll say, this was a terrible meditation. I really failed because all I did was think about stuff, who I have to call, what I got to do. I got to pick up a quart of milk, whatever it is. And boy, this was a failed meditation. This today was not good. And I'm guess when I read what you've written and others who write on this topic, I'm guessing that's not the best way to look at it.
Right. Yes. And right. There is no failed meditation. The attempt that to meditate, to become still within yourself, is the meditation. So some days you'll sit and you'll have these little moments, you know, where you have a sense of I have connected to the universal stream, you know, but right. Other times it's just a battle, you know, where you're sort of, but those battle times where you're sort of having these skirmishes with the mind are some of the biggest muscle building, spiritual muscle building experiences that you're going to have in a meditation. So they're sometimes in some ways more valuable than the ones where you have the, you know, the great big space kinds of meditations. Or are certainly equally valuable, but for a different reason.
What I found fascinating about your book, Opening to Meditation, is that unlike so much of what else I've read about this or studied, you have fewer rules where they will say, TM, for example, says Transcendental Meditation, you got to do it for 20 minutes twice a day, or you have to sit in a certain position, or your hands have to be, your fingers have to be up toward the sky, and you didn't seem to require any of that.
No. You know, having studied meditation all my life, I have seen, you know, and done every sort of meditation I think there might be. And what I was looking for and what I've experienced myself is there is a common denominator of a, it is not about how long you spend in meditation. It's the quality of that meditation and the sincerity that's inside that meditation that brings the depth, that awakens the soul inside the life. And so all of the, but to not disparage any of the techniques, all of the techniques that are out there from chanting or mudra or mantra, right, all of these technical terms inside of meditation, yeah. All of these are tools, you know? So it's like having a spiritual toolkit. And you can find, or we can find, the way that we're attracted to, like, if a friend invited you to something and then you're, you know, and they're chanting and you were like, oh, this is it for me. It is it for you for that moment. Like it becomes the doorway, right? But it's not the only doorway. There are hundreds and hundreds of styles of meditation and things to do within meditation to deepen that meditation, from breathing practices to, you know, affirmation or all kinds of things. And what we're attracted to tends to be our next steps.
So it doesn't matter whether you're doing mantra meditation where you have a word often in Sanskrit that you don't even know what it means, or focusing on your breath, the method doesn't matter at all?
No, it's what you're attracted to. All the methods work, you see. All these methods that are given are ancient, and so the ones that you feel attracted to, just the fact that maybe somebody might be listening to this conversation right now, and this becomes the first step of their meditation spiritual life, right? But it could be something else. And whatever way that we find ourselves, that's when you start to trust the soul's direction, in a sense, that this is the next step, whatever that next step be for us, and to trust that place that there's a reason that, you know, you found this particular author or teacher or experience in meditation, that that is the way that is designed for your highest good.
How has your life changed since meditating?
In every way. There's no part of my life that hasn't been touched. Every conversation I have, everything I do is full of my meditation practice. I do spiritual counseling almost all day long. So I'm working with people at a very, very deep and inner place, different than psychological, but spiritual soul perspective. And from that place, because we were talking about writing from meditation. When I'm working, I'm also inside my meditation practice, in a sense, even though I'm engaged like we are engaged, there's a part of me that's running through that filter, soul to soul, with you or whoever is in front of me. Well, that creates a kind of depth of meaning and connection with the world, with each other, with myself, with you, that is powerful.
So I'm wondering, though, you must have off days where that moment is not there, where you're not living in the moment, where the meditation isn't working. Even you, I'm guessing, it doesn't work all the time, right?
No, but I can reconnect to it, right? So I just had a cold the other for a, you know, a week last week, and I was so tired, and my mind wasn't working very well. And I would still, even though I was pretty much out of it in terms of how I felt in my body, there's another right. part of me that's still connected to the meditation. And on some level, I meditated through that sickness, I guess. Huh. What I love about meditation is that you can take it with you, right? You don't need anything outside yourself in order to get it. You have it with you all the time, your breath, your awareness. That's really what you're developing. So no matter what the conditions of our life might be, there's a place within us that we can reconnect to ourselves. So even if I'm having a hard day or a bad day, or I'm in judgment, or I find myself reactive to something, which I normally wouldn't. For me, when I'm feeling reactive to something, to me, that becomes extremely curious now, because it isn't my natural response anymore so much, you know. But when it does come up, which it does, then I can return to my meditation practice and get that bigger mind or that bigger view of like a higher perspective of that situation or that person or whatever I'm reacting to. For instance, watching the news can be extremely upsetting, right? Like, what are we going to do about this problem in the world, you know? And all that reactivity that comes with that, you know, that I become, when I'm reacting to the news, part of the problem. When I can watch the news from a place of heart, I become part, we become part of the solution to that problem.
You have an interesting line in the book when you say, when we sit to meditate, we become aware of how we're creating our reality and how we can reshape it as we go along. You can create your own reality through meditation or change reality?
Yes, well, we're creating our own reality anyway, all the time, whether we realize it or not. But when we meditate, there becomes a consciousness, that filter that we talked about earlier, that universal filter, that soul filter, I would call it, that you're starting to look through higher mind at the life. And so instead of accidentally creating our reality, we become consciously creating into our reality. And that's a big difference.
Talk about watching your thoughts instead of joining them. What does that mean?
Well, that's probably, you know, the biggest muscle that we have in a meditation is when the first thing that a new meditator will experience is their minds, right? So we sit down, we sit and meditate, and the first thing that we encounter are our thinking, right? The thinking kind of machine of the mind. And so the first thing we're going to see is, oh, I got to remember to call that person. Oh, don't forget to go to the store later. Oh, sure. You know, wasn't that really sad what that person said? And, you know, all of that thinking that happens. And one of the first things that a meditator is taught is to observe their thoughts. So you begin to realize that you are not the thoughts. You are just in observation of the thought.
I guess we identify so much with our thoughts. We think we are, and maybe we also, we kind of merge with our moods, with our mind, with whatever we think is happening, and to see them as separate, giving that space between the thought or the feeling and we are, kind of enables us to see it more clearly, doesn't it?
Yes, because there's a presence in our thoughts, and there's a guidedness or a perception. One of the things I talk a lot about is the difference between judgment and perception. And it's a discerning discrimination of mind in a way. So as we look at a situation, rather than going into judgment, I think this about that, or this should be different because I think this about that, there becomes a different point of view which says, this is happening. And in that place of this is, right? I like this person, I don't like this person, or I don't like this situation, or I do like this situation, becomes my opinion about it. That's a judgment. Or I can just observe the situation and say, this is. And that leaves me more creative to it.
Without judgment. But letting go of judgment certainly is a difficult hill for many of us to climb, isn't it?
Yeah, it's sort of the number one and only tenet inside spirituality is not to judge or to work on judgment and to recognize when we're in judgment. And how we can tell when we're in judgment is we're upset. you know, almost always we're in reaction to say, that's different. I don't like the difference. And when we realize, you know, in a bigger and bigger world that's more and more connected, the world gets smaller and smaller. And all of a sudden, you know, we're interacting with different kinds of people and with different points of view, and the world is getting smaller and smaller. And this type of awareness is more and more important, because we are, it is like, love the difference, you know, to appreciate that difference in each other becomes part of the creative solution to our peace on earth, on this planet.
Sure. The other thing that I struggle with is also, beside judgment, is attachment. Yes. And I know that all the great spiritual masters say we got to practice non-attachment. I'm guessing that meditation helps you achieve that as well.
Yes, and well, in the most simple way too, every time that you observe your thought, right? If I watch my thoughts, I am in that moment detaching from my thoughts. Because now, instead of being sort of in the dream of daydreaming or reimagining a conversation I just had, I am present to that, to the moment, which that conversation was yesterday, right? It's no longer. And so that is the practice of detachment. And the attachment is, I want to be right. I want to make my point. I want them to like me. I want, you know, whatever my agenda.
I want to get that red wagon for Christmas, whatever it is that you want to get in your life, right?
Exactly.
But you may not get it.
No, and trusting that whatever you do get is perfect anyway, you know, whether you get it or don't get it. But this detachment, when one of the metaphors I use when we meditate is to observe your thoughts like you're watching a parade go by. And so in that sense, you know, if you're in the audience just watching a parade go by, you say, oh, there's the trombones and here come the clowns. And, you know, and we're observing each thought, but we are not the thought. We're not the clown. We're not the trombone. We are just in observation. And that is the practice of detachment.
We're talking to Diana Lang. Opening to Meditation is her new book. Another interesting point you make in your book is that when you are having a moment of truth in your meditation, it feels like love. Could you expand upon that thought?
Oh, I love that you brought that up. I love that you read my book too. That just makes me so happy.
I thought it would be a good idea before I talk to you.
I really appreciate it. Yeah. Love is, to me, universal consciousness, divine consciousness is love. And when you meditate, you're connecting to that divine love. When we meditate and we connect to that divine love, there is no judgment, right, in that divine love. There is only love. So one of the ways you can recognize when you're in a meditation is you are in an experience, in the state of love. Anything that's not that is the ego, right? That's the ego creating, you know, well, you know, that you know, you'll be a good person when you, you know, do this action, or when you get your degree, or, you know, find the right relationship, or whatever we measure ourselves by. But soul makes no judgment of any kind. It just loves. And when we hook up to that love, it's like an engine. It's like an accelerator. We're connecting to something that is huge, adds huge velocity and power to the life, because we're connected sort of purely into love.
If you have a problem, do you ask yourself, can you help me solve the problem, reverse that before you go into a meditation? And can you then be guaranteed that some way or other you'll get the answer?
Yes, I do this every day. Any issues that are happening in my life, like we were talking earlier about, if you're having an issue with someone, or someone's just agitating, or you just don't like them, or those kind of, I bring that person or that situation into my meditation, and I sort of offer it into the meditation. And in offering into the meditation, what I'm looking for is higher perspective. What I'm looking for is love. Again, one of the things that I offer we call them world service meditations. And these are free, you know, call-in things where people can call in from wherever they are on the planet and meditate together. So there's hundreds of people meditating together about the problem of, let's say, the ocean, of plastic islands in the ocean, or the problem in the Middle East, or whatever it be, right? The subject of the day. And we bring all this consciousness to this issue, which is a world issue in this case, but it could just as well be a personal issue. Because there's, in terms of intensity, it's not more or less. But when 100 people come together to meditate about a world condition, we are adding a note of hope, a note of faith, a note of higher solution, which isn't necessarily a war, right? To inspire the minds of the lawmakers or the politicians that are involved to come to a higher position. And it's one of the most valuable things to do. And it feels so powerful when you're doing it. It's really amazing.
The people who run Transcendental Meditation have always said if they could just get a third of the world to meditate, it would be a very different place. You must have some thoughts on how the world would be different if indeed we were all, or a significant number of us more, were meditators.
Yeah, it would change the world. Deepak Chopra says this great thing. He says if every child at 8 years old was taught to meditate just for that 1 year, it would change the world because it would influence the way their brain organized as they were in that time of massive learning and massive mentalizing. To teach that child at that particular age too would awaken the consciousness of a whole generation. What is happening is, you know, a lot of the world does meditate now. You know, when I do these calls, for instance, there's hundreds of people on the call, but there's thousands and thousands and tens of thousands more that are also meditating around the world, all in different places. And I call it like lights on the planet. And I imagine it like that, like little points of light, like little lighthouses in a way, all spread out across the world that are in commonality around highest solution, loving solution.
I want to go back to what we were talking about a moment ago, and you have a chapter called Common Questions, chapter 16 in your book, and you were talking, we were a moment ago talking about if you ask a question or ask the universe to solve a problem before going into meditation, and you quote Matthew 7:7 at the beginning of that chapter, ask and it is given. Are you saying that whatever you ask for, you're going to get if you put the question or the desire out before going into a meditation? I can't imagine you always get what you want.
Well, we don't get what we want, that's for sure. But that's because usually we're in resistance to what we want. You know, that's a whole other concept. You know, it's back to creating our own reality. And this is a big, big, big thought. But yes, you can have anything you want. But hopefully when you line up with the soul, what you want tends to be for the highest good of all concerned. You know, it's not just, you know, what do I get? You know, on the other hand, you know, for instance, money, when there's enough money, there can be more generosity, right? When there's not enough money, it's harder to be generous as much as we would maybe like to be. So it's like learning to, I mean, this is going to sound crazy probably to you, but there's a bunch of us that have been meditating for rain in Los Angeles because we're having such a bad drought here.
Because of the drought,
yeah. Yeah. And it's been raining. And we, you know, what we were talking about in a time of year that we do not get rain here. So we're all going, wow, that's interesting. And our biggest work in terms of calling rain and sort of receiving rain was the receiving aspect. I think that, you know, we all want a good relationship. We all want a good, you know, feel like we're contributing something and, you know, all of these high things. But we're also in resistance to what we want, like, well, I don't feel worthy of that, or I don't have enough, you know, I'm not a good enough, you know, artist, or to be a well-known artist, or whatever we believe.
Well, you're not who you want to be in your life for whatever reason.
Right. And what that does is it causes resistance to the manifestation of what we really want. And so, you know, we become our own worst enemy sometime, or we can be our own best, you know, helper.
Well, when you talk about non-judgment and non-attachment, the other part of that troika to me is non-resistance, which I guess is also a part of what you might be able to learn to do better in meditation.
Wow. And that is beautiful. He said one of the most powerful meditations you can do is say to, you know, as an affirmation meditation is to say, I resist nothing. because you start, what you're not resisting is you are aligning with the soul. And so by aligning with the soul, you can trust that. If there's not a soul alignment, you could just end up sideways in your life, you know, and not know why and feel a victim of it. But when you're meditating, you're connecting to the soul, and there's nothing to resist because everything is in perfect timing.
The idea of accepting that this perfection and imperfection, no matter what happens in your life, in its own way is perfect, is a very difficult. It sounds great. It sounds like a wonderful concept. But getting your mind around it is a whole different matter. Learning to accept that concept is difficult.
Exactly. Just like when I was just sick recently, I was sick for almost 7 days. I'm never sick. And I was so sick this cold.
In fact, I think it was around the time we were going to originally do this interview.
Oh,
I think that's
right.
The way you're trying to avoid us. I understand.
That's right, Alan. That's right.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I couldn't have a voice. And so I'm melting down, and I'm supposed to be on the radio, right, over and over again. And yeah. I didn't have a voice. And I'm thinking, why is this happening to me? How did I create this? You know, and what it ended up being for me, and it was valuable as I melted down, right? Whatever it was, and there was a lot that I needed to understand about this step of my career, this reaching out past my ring, past not my comfort zone, all of that. I needed to look at that, because what I discovered was that the only thing that mattered is in these interviews, for instance, that I would say one true thing, because I needed to have integrity with myself. And I don't mean that, I mean one true thing that cuts through, right? Uh-huh. Like that opens up the world, that opens up the universe, one high true thing. And if I uh-huh. could do that, then I had done enough. Because there was a part of me when I was started doing these interviews that was feeling like I was performing rather than right. being authentic. You uh-huh. see?
Sure. Having done book interviews, I understand. It's you almost start to doing it by rote, and you get probably the same questions over and over again too. So that gets kind of boring for the interviewee. Hopefully, that's not the case here. You also say many extrasensory events can occur during meditation. What kind of events are you talking about?
Yeah, well, I sort of just touched that subject. I don't really get into it too much because it's so big. It could be a book in its own right, and in fact, the one
that's
I'm
a
working
book I'd
on
love
now.
To read.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the one I'm working on right now. And that one is about what happens when you meditate. And what happens when you meditate is everything. In terms of heightened sensory awareness, how that might show up in your life is, you know, in ways that you probably have experiences, that knowing someone's going to call and they do, right? That uh-huh. kind of, we say that as almost a joke. I knew you yeah. were going to call. And, uh-huh. you know, but it starts to be everything's like that, you know, that there's like no surprises in a sense, because everything, you become so present to life that you can sense what's coming. I call, when I do these world meditations, I call this sort of spiritual weather, because I can feel through my meditation what's happening around the planet. I can, in a sense, take the temperature, the pulse, right, of the planet through my meditation practice. Just as one example, certainly, you know, all the things of ESP, extrasensory perception, right, where you hear or you see or you perceive or you understand in that deeper way, all of these things become much, much brighter and stronger when you have a meditation practice.
What is it about meditation? What is it about the actual action itself of meditating that creates all these things? Extrasensory perception, calmness, less stress, focus, the ability to live your life in a different way. What is it about it that enables all of these other things to happen?
Yes, good, great question. And it's simple in a way. It is the detachment from the tyranny, I'm going to say it that
tyranny.
Way, of the ego.
Let's explore that phrase, tyranny of the ego. That's a great phrase. It's something we all have to fight, right?
Or love.
Oh, love. Right. Maybe if you love it, it goes away better than fighting it. You put out a fire with water, not with more fire. You don't fight fire with fire. You fight it with water. So the tyranny of the ego. The spiritual masters all say, you being one of them, get rid of the ego. Ego's no good. Is it always bad? Is the ego always a bad thing?
No, the ego is your friend, you know. Think of your ego as your humble servant. That, you know, it isn't usually. But, you know, all the corruption in the world and all the evil, I suppose, what we call evil in the world, is the ego running rampant without the filter of soul, right? You cannot do harm to someone when you're connected to the soul. You would not, because we're all one. By harming someone else, we're harming ourselves ultimately. And the only tenet in spirituality as a commandment, in a sense, is do no harm. Well, this is a huge concept, to do no harm, you know? And that that means do not harm yourself either. It means to not speak violently. It's certainly not to you know, make violence in the world, but not even to think violently, you know, so that the whole consciousness starts to change, to become more loving in every way. So and the other thing is, the ego is not the enemy. The ego is to be enlisted in service to the soul, in a sense. And then the ego is the thing that gets things done, you know, because we can't get rid of our egos. It's part of our human condition. But it can be trained, and that's what meditation does. It is trained to be in service to something higher than itself.
I love the fact that on the cover of this book, Opening to Meditation, you quote one of my heroes, although I've never talked to him, Gerald Jampolsky, whose book, Love is Letting Go of Fear, just the title itself is so affirming that I'm so glad to see him on the cover of your book.
Well, I was so honored to have him. That was his review of my book, basically, what's on the cover there.
That you open the door to meditation in clear, easy to understand language that makes the journey of meditation the most gentle one.
Right. And what an honor, you know, for him to say that. And don't you love a book where you don't even need to open the book because the title is so profound in its own right? Love is letting go of fear.
Right. Well, you say a gentle guided approach. And I think that goes to the notion of being gentle with ourselves, not judging ourselves, and allowing. And the point of allowing, meditation is simply a practice, is not of allowing, focusing on the moment, watching your thoughts, letting them go, and not fighting.
Right, right. I resist nothing, right? I resist nothing. It's back to this simple kind of perspective of where I am is where I'm supposed to be, even if it's a messy situation. When I walk through hospitals, and I often am, you know, with people and doing healings or whatever, that kind of work, I feel like if I can clear my field and get myself in a purified place just by walking down the hallway of that hospital, then I'm bringing light. And all of us are doing that. Or we're bringing fear, right? It's love or fear, right? That's the choice that we have to make all the time. If I'm afraid of hospitals and I go into a hospital in that state, I'm adding to the fear that's already there. But when I know the well-being of every single person in there and myself, I become part of their healing, in a sense, or all of our healings, including my own.
That's a wonderful way to sum this up. And it's called Opening to Meditation, the new book by Diana Lang. And I thank you very much for talking to us on Heal Planet.
Oh, it's so my pleasure, Alan. Thank you.
Thanks very much.